How should we read political polls? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are plenty of polls available to get a grasp of the mind of the voters. But how accurate are they? And how easily can those figures be manipulated to make any one candidate or party or ballot question look good or bad? We're joined by Fernand Amandi of the polling company Ben Dixon Amandi and host of the political podcast Strange Days. Well, Dwayne Wade is back in Miami, but will his return really help the team? Better yet, how do fans feel about Wade's return? Finally, a conversation with a Miami couple who have spent a lifetime collecting glass art from around the world. A lot of it is on display in a pavilion named for them at the University of Miami. All of that coming up today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, if you like stats, settle in and prepare to enjoy yourself. I'm not talking about the heat. That's later in the show. I'm not even talking about the Olympics. I'm talking about politics. This is a big election year, and the polls are already dropping and contradicting each other. Luckily, there's a premier polling firm right here in South Florida. It's Ben Dixon Amandi. They do polling for politicians and companies all over the world. And my guest is Fernand Amandi, who's going to tell us all about polling and how to understand polling. By the way, he's also, you'll recognize his voice, he's the host of the podcast Strange Days. He previously hosted a political talk show on WIOD in Miami. Fernand, it's a pleasure to finally get you in here.
Luis, a pleasure to be here, and congratulations on the new show.
Thank you.
Killing it here, man. I love this place. Love the show.
I appreciate it. Thank you. All right, let's talk polling. Because, as I said, it's an election year.
Boy.
I know, right? But, I mean, look, it's. I'm curious as to, you know, some of the things that you hear from people about polling. And is there any trust in polling right now? Do people, because you think about the last election, the 2016 election, and what polls were telling us and what happened?
Well, let me paraphrase Thomas Jefferson. Not all polls are created equal, right? There is a great distinction on the basis of how a poll is done and designed and put together. And unfortunately, Luis, what we have seen is because of the insatiable appetite for people to get the numbers, everybody wants to know what the state of the race is, what the state of play is, what Americans are thinking. And because, generally speaking, a well-designed, well-crafted, done poll is a little bit costlier than some of the others, you tend to have seen some shortcuts taken. And a lot of people have utilized the new technology to do what's called automated polls or online polls. And they think that if they have, you know, 17,000 people online, then that's going to be a representative sample. And sometimes, depending on how it's put together, it is. But other times, it's not. And unfortunately, with you see some of these polls that are not quite done to the scientific standards that I like to think our firm, Ben Dixon and Amandi, utilizes, and some of the other reputational firms do, it does end up leaving a little bit of a black eye on the industry, which is unfortunate because polling is really nothing more than a reflection of what public opinion is. And I think that's very important in this day and age.
What goes into making a good poll? What makes a bad poll bad?
Yeah. There are so many different variables that go into the construction of a poll. And, you know, without trying to glaze people over with the minutiae, fundamentally, it's making sure the audience that you're looking for is the right universe. Whether you're looking at voters, whether you're looking at residents or adults, you want to make sure you have the right sample, because on the basis of the sample, you're going to get the most accurate information. Then it's got to be designed in such a way, Luis, so that whatever audience or universe you're looking at, it's representative of everybody living in the area. Give you an example. Here in Miami-Dade County, if you were just to do a poll of 1,000 people and said it was a poll of Miami-Dade County, but you only polled people living in Hialeah, it wouldn't be a representative poll of Miami-Dade County, right? You'd be getting a pretty big sample size of Hialeah. So you got to balance it out. So make sure every potential person that's living in Miami-Dade County has an opportunity to participate in that poll.
How about when we have, you know, we hear about, you know, these new polls that seem to just pop up every now and again. And it's about anything, not just politics, but how do we figure which ones are trustworthy? I mean, right off the bat, is there a way to say maybe this is one we should pay attention to, or it's trash?
You know, it's a great question. And I think fundamentally, if you are a polling firm or a polling outfit, you live and die by your reputation, right? You live and die by a reputation that is based on the accuracy results and a track record that shows, hey, we're not treating this as an opportunity just to make news or just to get some brand identification out there. Our firm is done and constructed in such a way so that you want to make sure whenever you're putting a poll result out, you can defend it scientifically on the basis of scientific standards. And like I said earlier, there's such a demand. All of the news outlets, whether it's radio or television or even the online websites, they want to be able to say definitively, this is what people are thinking. So there is a great desire to get poll content out there. Polls are very powerful because you can say in a numerical way, this is what public opinion is on any given subject. But a lot of times when the shortcuts are taken, it ends up hurting. So you have organizations that I'm not going to name specific ones here, but you've had some that have taken these shortcuts either for methodological reasons or financial reasons or cost reasons, and it's ended up hurting the overall result. And I think that's why some people say fake polls, fake news. And unfortunately, in some cases, they're right.
You know what? I've always heard that sometimes the question and how it's worded is going to
absolutely
get a different response. So, I mean, what's an example of that? And again, not a real life example, but can you think of like how you would word a question maybe a little bit differently that's going to get the response that you want?
I'll give you a perfect local example. Coconut Grove is where I happen to call home. It's actually where our firm is based. And we were asked to do a study recently on the Coconut Grove Playhouse debate. Now, for any of you listening that know the Coconut Grove area, you know the residents, a very passionate group of people in Coconut Grove. And this is a very passionate debate. There are some folks that want to kind of continue with what Miami-Dade County's current plan is for the poll, for the playhouse. Others that say, you know what, we need to think of an alternative approach. And the way you balance the questions is critically important, because if you do it in such a way that it's leading, or if you're kind of stacking the deck in how you construct those questions, people can, I think, rightfully say, hey, you're not presenting an unbalanced, unbiased instrument. You're creating what is called a push poll. A push poll is really where you're trying to manipulate public opinion by leading people with stacked or loaded language to a conclusion through your questions. And we have to make sure, not just us, but any other reputable polling firm, that they present and design the questions in such a way that it's not seen that way, because otherwise you're manipulating, and that's not what a sound political poll or a public opinion instrument is supposed to do.
Do campaigns keep polling results secret unless it's good for them?
It happens all of the time. Because remember, a good poll, a well-designed poll, will give you data that a lot of people don't actually have access to. It's an instrument. I like to call polling modern-day GPS. You know, you can get somewhere today without GPS, just like you can do something without a poll. But it takes a lot of the guesswork out of it if it's done right, because a poll kind of gives you a layout, a panorama of how to get there and what to do with a lot less confusion than if you were just kind of doing it on your own. Sometimes a campaign will say, look, this is a really bad poll result for us. We don't want anybody to know this, but we're going to utilize this information to kind of make improvements in areas where we find we're vulnerable or weak. On the other side, Lewis, you may take a poll that's like, wow, this is gangbusters. I want everybody in the world to know it. And they will then take that poll and try and make it public as a communications vehicle. So it all depends on what the results are and what the intended use of those results are.
So let's go back to 2016. So
let's
we had all these polls telling us different things. And a lot of people knew, they thought they knew what was going to happen. And then the election happened. And the polls came. All of a sudden, people are questioning, well, why were we even paying attention to these polls?
Well, listen, I am certainly not going to rise up statesmanlike and make the case for all of the polling in 2016 was right on the money. But I will say this. There is a great big misnomer that a lot of the national polls were off. And I think that's not true. If you look at what happened in the days going into the weekend before the election, if you take the poll of polls, the national polling average, all of them pretty much had Hillary Clinton ahead by anywhere from 1 to 4 to 5 points in some cases. You remember the national popular result in terms of the, not the Electoral College, Lewis, but the national popular result. What happened? Hillary Clinton did what?
She won by millions.
She won by millions, almost 3 million votes, and which translates to about an average of 2.5 points more than what Donald Trump had gotten in the national popular vote. So in that regard, the polls were right. Let me tell you what was actually wrong, if not dead wrong. Some of the polling in some of the key states, whether it was Wisconsin, whether it was Michigan, whether it was Pennsylvania or Ohio. And I think what happened there were a few factors. Number one, we didn't see the prominence or the number of polls that we saw in some of the other battleground states. Here at home in Florida, Florida was always, in all of the polls going into that last weekend, a close race. Some had Hillary Clinton up a point or two, some had Trump up a point, some had it tied. It ended up reflecting what the result is, because there's always a little caveat in polling world. It's three words that a lot of people don't like to think about when it comes to interpreting result. It's called margin of error. Every single poll, Lewis, has a margin of error. What that means is the result could be impacted plus or minus a couple of points or two based on what the margin of error says. I think what happened was you didn't see the numbers and the type of polling in those states like Wisconsin and Michigan and even Pennsylvania to a certain extent, which were those high quality polls, live operator polls where you actually have people talking to people with large sample sizes. The bigger the number of people interviewed, the more confidence you have in the statistical results. And I think that created a blind spot.
So do you think that in the next election or any election moving forward that we're going to change the way we view polls or even how we poll?
I think we have to. Polling, like any other technology, is just that. It's a technology. It was something that really started off with its origins and like going door to door, literally paper to paper. The technology of the telephone allowed that to change. It changed the dynamic. Now you have this little thing called a smartphone, which pretty much everybody now has. So you find now ways in which the new technology is evolving to always get to the sacred holy grail of polling, which is accuracy. You want to be as accurate as possible. That's what gives confidence, not only in a poll, but in a polling company that gives those results.
Again, I'm talking with Fernand Amande. He is with the premier polling firm here in South Florida, Ben Dixon Amande. He's also the host of the podcast Strange Days. We're going to talk about that here in just a moment. Talking about polling, I'm wondering if, it's gotten any easier or harder, or maybe it hasn't changed at all when it comes to actually reaching out to people to do polling and ask the questions. Are people as receptive, or is it getting harder to get people to? And how about this? Also, getting an honest answer.
You know, it is. But again, this comes down to how you design the questions and how you create an environment. Because again, like anything in life, you know, you can just be jonesing for the greatest, juiciest cheeseburger you've ever wanted in your life. And you think a cheeseburger is kind of hard to mess up, right? But you've gone to a couple places, I'm sure, and they just, for the life of them, can't put together that cheeseburger. Whereas you go to a couple other places you can count on, they're going to make sure that patty's nice and toasted. They're going to make sure the cheese is all melted with all the ingredients and the condiments. That's how a good poll is constructed. You got to have all of the right ingredients done systematically correct. And in the context of how you load up and create some of these questions, always, again, accuracy is the North Star. Accuracy is always the guiding light. Because what happens, Lewis, if you're not putting together or designing an accurate instrument for a poll? You're arriving at a result which is not reflective of reality or public opinion. That's only going to hurt the credibility of the poll and the company going forward. So you can never take those chances. And what the new technology has done is, in some ways, some people have said, opted out. You know what? I don't want to participate. I'm inundated with calls. But what's also happened is it's given us an opportunity through different ways. Now we can reach people on cell phones, which before was a little bit harder to do. You can reach people still on typical landlines. You can supplement people that literally don't have a landline anymore. A lot of people now probably listening, I haven't had a landline in years. Or people that maybe only use their cell phone through an internet service. You can get those people now online. So it's constantly making sure you're never missing or having a blind spot, because that will undermine the holy grail, which is accuracy.
Does it have to be a conversation with a person, or can we just get to the point where people can answer polls through an email or text or without having to actually answer a call? It almost seems like when you think about smartphones as an example,
right?
I think it's funny how in today's world, people almost get annoyed when you call them. Why not just text me? It's easier. Even when a family member calls and says, why'd you call me? You could just text me. I'd rather answer that.
This is an excellent question. And I am a big proponent still of live operator polls. And I'll tell you the reason why. With a live operator poll, you can do what's called screens. In other words, you can screen people by asking them questions in real time to make sure you're confirming that you're going after the audience, right? Whereas, let's say, I have two young kids. They operate my phone better than I do. a lot of times people will call me and my son will answer the phone and they think, you know, they're talking to me and it's actually my son. If you were to do a text poll, you're not necessarily certain you're speaking to your intended audience. Whereas a live operator poll, for example, if you're talking to voters, you can say, hey, is this Luis Hernandez? Are you registered to vote? Yes. Do you live in this area? You've already eliminated some of the confirmation bias by establishing you're talking to your intended audience.
Again, talking with Fernando Mondi, we're talking about polling and how it all works, how to put it together, and do you trust it? You know, how can you trust it? And well, you know what? Listen, we got an election year, so we're going to be hearing a lot about polls in the coming months. Let's take a break, continue this conversation in just a moment here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. So I've been having this conversation with Fernando Mondi. You recognize him. He's from the podcast Strange Days with Fernando Mondi. Also, he is with the polling firm Ben Dixon Amandi. And we've been talking about polling and how it works. And you know what? I wanted to ask you two other quick things about polling. One is I wanted to get your thoughts on these polling aggregators like Nate Silver, who's become very famous over the last couple of elections, or the website Real Clear Politics. Your take on these guys?
You know, I think it's another interesting tool. You're always trying. I mean, I hate at the risk of repeating myself. What is the most important thing in polling? Accuracy. So you want to try and figure out any metric, Lewis, that gives you the accurate results. The problem that I have with some of the aggregators, be it Nate Silver's 538 and some of the others you mentioned, is they have into the input of some of the polls that they consider some, I think, bad faith polls or polls that I certainly wouldn't trust, and then it has the ability to sway things. I would much rather, if you're going to do an aggregator, go by almost the gold standard, five or six polling companies that are polling outfits that you know don't take any of those shortcuts for either financial reasons or time reasons, and on that basis be able to do a much more precise prediction, because all you have to do is look at the results. I think it was 538. I'll never forget this on election night. They were the morning of, it was like 97% chance Hillary Clinton wins. Then when the polls closed at 7, it was 95%. And then, you know, the poll we got later in the evening, it was 58% she wins, then 45%, and then 79% Trump wins. I mean, what is the purpose of having an aggregator when the results are going to flail that wildly?
And by the way, you talk about the gold standard, then who are they?
I think Ben Dixon and Monty's the gold standard. Okay. Of course, I was going to say that. No, yeah. There are some excellent companies out there doing polling. I still think, believe it or not, the Gallup organization is one of them. The Pew organization, Pew Research, you can take it to the bank a lot of times. In certain states, California has the Field Poll, which unfortunately doesn't operate as much as they used to, but they always did good work. So there's some really good polling companies out there.
You, or Ben Dixon Amandi, I should say, is known for polling in English and Spanish. Mm-hmm. Is it as simple as just translating the English questions, or do you have to go in and you have to rewrite this different? Because again, it's about how you set up the question.
It's double the work, which is sometimes we have to charge double the cost, because I don't believe in translating. I believe in trans-creating. And what that means is you sometimes have to put together an instrument in whatever language you're looking at. And increasingly in America, certainly in diverse places like South Florida, if you don't do multilingual polling, meaning you offer it in the language of preference of a given segment of that community, it's another blind spot. It's another thing that's going to impact your accuracy. But a simple translation does not work, because a lot of times it's conveying concepts, conveying elements, and again, without loading or creating stacked language, it's going to lead you to a different result. So you almost have to redesign and recreate in the different language the new poll.
You guys did a famous poll in Cuba a few years ago. How did you get that? How did you do that?
Well, I'll tell you the origins of it. I was watching Raul Castro one day. This was shortly after President Obama normalized relations with Cuba. And he was talking about how the Cuban people didn't really care about this, that, and the other. And I remember, you know, as a pollster, the pollster's challenge is always, well, how do you know that? Where are the numbers? Show me the damn numbers, Raul Castro. And there'd never been a poll in Cuba before. And I'm of Cuban-American descent. So I said, you know what? we're going to do a poll in Cuba. Now, you have to do it very carefully, very secretly, because it's illegal to poll in Cuba. But we actually had, that had been a dream project for years, and we had kind of slowly but surely put the pieces in place to do it. And when I reached out to my team, I said, do you think we can do it now? They said, well, it's worth a try. We used all of the same scientific protocols that we would use in any other country in the world and actually got it done. And what was satisfying to me is it was the first time ever, I think, certainly in the 21st century, that we gave voice to the Cuban people. The Cuban people have always had somebody speak on their behalf, whether it was the news media or one of the totalitarian dictators over there or some government official. But this was an honest to goodness, unfiltered sense, scientifically designed, of what the Cuban people thought about things. And the results, I thought, were fascinating.
And afterwards, what did you hear? What did you hear, especially from the Cuban government?
Well, they I think some of these things are classified, but I'll put it this way. I'm not allowed in Cuba anytime soon.
Again, talking with Fernand Amandi, talking about polling. He is with Bendix and Amandi. But he also is the host of the podcast, Strange Days with Fernand Amandi. How, you know what, you had the radio show at WID, and now you're doing the podcast. You know, how different is it, you know, from doing a radio show to doing a podcast? And look, it's still, you're sitting across from all of these talking heads and pundits and all kinds of people, but is there a difference? You're talking into a microphone.
You know, there is a major difference. The thing about a podcast, you don't have breaks, right? And breaks is what changes the whole dynamic, because when you're operating in a format like this one, even on WLRN, luckily you don't have as many breaks here, so you can kind of have extended conversations. But the idea that at some point you got to bring the conversation to a pause or an end point to go to break or go to commercial has an impact, whereas in a podcast, you don't have that limitation. And I have found that a lot of the guests that we've been lucky to have, and we've had some really interesting, amazing, spectacular A-list guests, what they enjoy is to be able to come on and really convey a thought, a concept, in a conversational style. And I think that's what makes the podcast an interesting challenge, too.
Don't you also, in the podcast, I mean, you really could be more of yourself. And how you lean politically comes out a lot more in the podcast, right, than when you were doing the radio show?
I'm not so sure about that.
No?
I was pretty direct. And some people may say that's why I'm not on WIOD anymore. But okay. No, you're right. I mean, there is a truth to the fact that you certainly don't have the safety net of the FCC to contend with. And if the expletive every now and again for emphasis wants to come out, you don't have to catch yourself or edit necessarily that thing out. But, you know, I do, there is a kind of a spontaneity to the podcast. There is kind of an unfiltered aspect that I think for a lot of people, you kind of, if it's done right, provides these really interesting insights. And I think that's why so many people around the country and around the world now, with the ability to have the technology that creates podcasts, are really putting out some compelling content.
Well, because I wondered, like, you know, I asked that question because I wondered if, you know, you had more freedom in the podcast because you lean left, you're a Democrat. And so, you know, and IOD has been known more for its right leaning. You know, and so did you have more freedom doing your podcast then?
Yeah. I mean, there is, I mean, the beauty also of the podcast is, you know, you are the editorial content producer, you know, you have a say over everything, and there is absolutely zero limitation. So that's a very liberating sense. Whereas obviously when you're doing terrestrial radio for a big corporation, you do have to sometimes operate within certain limitations of either the format or content wise.
Do you, did you notice anything different in your audience? Podcasts tend to sway a little bit more younger, you know, but compared to radio, where we see tend to sway a little bit more older, but have you seen a difference in your audience?
You know, I have. On IOD, the terrestrial radio, you tend to get a little bit skew older. The audience is a little bit older, although we were really kind of getting younger. But the podcast, what's amazing is it's not just generational, it's everywhere. Literally, the beauty of a podcast is you are around the world. You're 24/7. I mean, if you had Wi-Fi on Mars, you could pick up the podcast. So you get this kind of diversity of thought and opinion from all of the hues that make up humanity. So that's kind of enriching. I actually got it from Nairobi, Kenya, some feedback the other day on one of the podcast things. So that's kind of cool.
All right, again, talking with Fernand Amandi. He is the host of the podcast Strange Days, again, also with Bendix and Amandi. Some really fascinating conversation about how polling is done, and you're going to hear all about polls from now through the rest of the year.
Polls.
Because it is an election year. Fernando, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Lewis. Appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Still to come, Dwayne Wade back in Miami. Is it good for the team? Better yet, is it good for us, the fans? It's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Well, he's back.
Wade for three. Kaboom! He's back!
Dwayne Wade back in Miami with the Heat. He returned to the Heat last week in a trade between the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Miami Heat. It's 2 years since he left the team to go play for the Chicago Bulls first. You know, if you're a fan, how do you feel about D-Wade's return? Is it going to be good for the team? Or are you over your anger that he left in the first place? You can always tweet us. Find us at WLRN Sundial. You can also text the word Sundial to 63735. Some of you have responded. Amy from Boca Raton says, thrilled. That's all she said. That's all that has to be said. Kalina Concepcion from Hollywood says, I think he needs to make up his mind and stop jumping from team to team. But it is interesting that he came back. Hopefully, he can bring some winning back to the team. Well, joining us now is the Miami Herald's Miami Heat reporter, Manny Navarro. Welcome back, Manny.
Hi, Lewis. How are you?
Oh, doing all right. Oh, I'm doing all right. But let me ask you this. How are Heat fans doing? It seems like they're pretty excited about this.
So much happier than they were just a couple weeks ago, that's for sure. This has really breathed life back into this season. You know, the breakup between Dwayne Wade and the Heat a couple of years ago, there were a lot of fans who were obviously depressed over it. They were always hoping to see Dwayne Wade finish his career with the Heat, and now he's back, and it looks like that's what's going to happen. He's going to play his final game in a Miami Heat uniform.
You know, what was the relationship between President Pat Riley and Dwayne Wade when they left a couple of years ago? It didn't end nicely.
No, it was really an argument over money. You know, Dwayne Wade felt that the Heat did not make him a priority when he was a free agent in the summer of 2016. They went out and they signed Hassan Whiteside to a 4-year, $98 million deal. And Dwayne was sort of left on the side, and the Heat offered him a 2-year, $40 million contract that wasn't to Dwayne's liking. He felt like he had a really good playoff series that year after the Heat made it to Game 7 of the Eastern Conference semifinals, and he thought, okay, I've sacrificed a lot of money in the past, you know, when LeBron James and Chris Bosh signed here. I've been the face of the franchise. I want to be the highest paid guy on the team. And Pat Riley told him no. He said, look, I if you want to keep winning, I've got to be able to spend money on other guys. And so Dwayne said, okay, that's it. I'm leaving. And he decided he was going to go home to Chicago. And their relationship really, if you look at it, it went from being something where they won three championships together to all of a sudden, you know, Dwayne feels disrespected. And, you know, this homecoming, coming back, the way they patched up their relationship is really a nice little story.
Yeah, I mean, can we say it's patched up? They're on good terms now? Is that, I mean...
Yeah, I think so. Look, a couple weeks ago, Henry Thomas, who was the agent for Dwayne Wade for many years, and Udonis Haslem and Chris Bosh as well, who dealt with the Heat obviously a lot, he passed away, and Dwayne and Udonis Haslem were at his funeral in Chicago, and Pat Riley decided to go. And when the two of them were there, you know, Dwayne was obviously grieving. Pat came up behind him and grabbed him and gave him a big hug. And just it really felt to Dwayne like, okay, it's time to let go of this anger. It's time to let go of the way that I feel about Pat right now. And it really smoothed things over. And Dwayne said words didn't even have to be spoken. It was just the embrace, just the acknowledgement from both guys that they missed each other. They missed being around each other. And so I think, you know, sometimes you have an argument with a friend, yeah, feelings are hurt, and Dwayne Wade needed this, and Pat Riley needed this to sort of move on from that moment.
So let's take a look at the team as it is now and Dwayne Wade's return. I mean, the team is a playoff team, you know, lower seed, but still, you know, he's in the twilight of his career. You know, so what does he bring to the team? Does he really make them better? Obviously, he brings the energy. Everybody's excited about Dwayne Wade back, but really, what does he do?
Well, I mean, look, everybody, I think, has the image of Dwayne Wade the last time he played in a Heat uniform, which was the guy who was still taking shots at the end of games. You remember that playoff series against Charlotte when the rowdy fan for the Hornets, the purple shirt guy, as we called him, was standing up and talking trash to Dwayne, and Dwayne was sitting there hitting three-pointers to lift the Heat to victory. He's not that guy anymore. He's not that guy who's going to shoulder the load. He's 36 years old. His minutes have diminished. His leaping ability has diminished. But he can still help a team win. And the one thing about this Heat team, earlier this season when Deion Waiters went down to a season-ending ankle injury, the Heat really lost their go-to guy in the fourth quarter. And it's a role that multiple guys have shared. Wayne Ellington has taken and made a lot of big shots. Goran Dragic has taken and made a lot of big shots. James Johnson. It's been about four or five different guys who have really shared that responsibility. Dwayne obviously has the experience of what it's like to have the ball in your hands in crunch time, what you have to do, the type of decisions you have to make. Do you pass it to a teammate? Do you take the shot yourself? In the last minute and 6 seconds of Friday's win, which was Dwayne Wade's first game back with the team, Eric Spoelstra put him back into the game because the Heat was blowing essentially a 19-point lead, gotten down to 4 points, and Dwayne comes in and makes a big block on the defensive end to help salvage that victory. And so those are the type of plays that you can expect Dwayne to make moving forward. Is he going to score 30 points, 40 points in a game? I doubt it. But he can definitely still make winning plays for you and help calm the team down when the pressure gets on.
All right, so when you think about all of the amazing athletes who have played in Miami in any sport, where's Dwayne Wade? Is he Miami's, South Florida's most popular athlete ever? Or, I mean, do you have anybody above him?
Well, look, as somebody who was born and raised in Miami and absolutely loved the Miami Dolphins, I will tell you that in my heart, Dan Marino will always be number one. But it, from a journalistic standpoint and just knowing the situation, the Miami Dolphins were a great franchise before Dan Marino came to town. They won two Super Bowls with Don Shula. They had the undefeated season. Dan Marino's run was phenomenal, but he never won a Super Bowl. Dwayne Wade came in with Pat Riley and really took the Heat from being a playoff contender with Alonzo Mourning and Tim Hardaway to all of a sudden being a championship franchise. They've had three parades since Dwayne Wade came to town. The Dolphins still haven't had any, and I think for that reason alone, Dwayne Wade is the number one all-time athlete in South Florida history.
All right. How much longer do you think he's going to last?
I don't know. You know, it's really interesting. I think a lot of it's going to have to do with the roster situation with the Heat. They're very deep at the guard position. They've got guys who are making a lot of money. Tyler Johnson's contract is supposed to balloon up to $19.2 million next year. Right now, he's a backup. You have Deion Waiters, who's going to come back from injury. You have some young players that they like, Rodney Magruder, Josh Richardson, who's really bloomed. So where does Dwayne Wade and his minutes fit into the whole thing? And will he be willing to take a league minimum contract? If he'd already have the salary cap accounted for next season, got all their money basically handed out with guys who are coming back. So I think this is going to come down to, can Dwayne Wade still help the Heat win games? There's no question he can help sell tickets and improve TV ratings, but can he help the team win games? And you know, what kind of deal can he work out with Pat Riley?
Manny Navarro again, Miami Heat reporter with the Miami Herald. It's always a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Good talking to you, Lewis. Take care.
All right. And just a couple more comments from some of our listeners. Alex Garcia says his return is a sure sign that he will retire either this season or next, which is sad. Even though he might retire, at least he returned home for his final year, which excites every person in Miami, whether they watch basketball or not. And Natalie, Matt Les from Miami, ecstatic. Miami is home. This is D. Wade's house. Well, the Heat are in Toronto tonight. Still to come, a chat about one of Miami's largest glass art collections. A couple have been putting it together for years. That's next on Sundial, here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, art made of glass and South Florida are a natural combination. You might have visited the Fairchild Gardens in Coral Gables during one of the Dale Cholula shows when it was sometimes hard to tell what was a living tropical plant and what was artwork. One of the best collections of artworks made of glass is on display all year round. It's in the Paley Pavilion at the University of Miami's Low Art Museum, also in Coral Gables. And we're going to talk now to the collectors and donors who are responsible for it, Myrna and Sheldon Paley. It is such a pleasure to have you both here. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you for having us.
All right. You know what, Myrna, you were an art teacher. Were you an artist?
Well, no. I was an art teacher.
Okay.
It's a difference.
What attracted you to glass art?
Well, we've always been collectors of art. And when glass appeared, it was just an unbelievable medium. It calls you into it. It's not solid. It's just drawing, really. It's fantastic.
Sheldon, what about for you? What's the draw to glass?
Well, I came with Myrna. Myrna was the art teacher. Myrna was the person that introduced me to it. And I just felt that the way that the glass was used was so, it was ephemeral. It draws you into it. Just marvelous.
Do you guys remember the first piece that you ever bought?
Yes, we bought it at an art show. It was a vessel. And the funny part about it is that we never heard of the artist again. Many, many years later, Sheldon and I were in New York City. We went to the Metropolitan of Art. They had a glass exhibit, and there was the artist. He had a piece there. But I haven't seen or heard of him since.
Really? What described the piece? What was
it's
the
a vessel.
Piece? Oh, yeah?
A small bowl.
Okay.
But it's so beautiful. He was way before his time.
So, yep. I mean, at that point, you get this. I mean, did you think, okay, we're going to start collecting art?
No.
Especially glass?
No. You know, piece here, piece there. And all of a sudden, we have 300 pieces. I don't know how it happened. I mean, my living room, 6 people now come in, and it's crowded. It's amazing. I go to the museum, and I look at the exhibit, and I said, no. That we can't have bought all of that. It didn't come from my house. It's unbelievable. It's a life of its own.
Sheldon, how long have you got? When did this start? How long have you been collecting?
We've been collecting since the middle 70s. And as Myrna said, the original artists, they were craftsmen. They would sit by a furnace up in the mountains or something and create little perfume bottles, little bowls, and little this. And then they would show them and sell them at the art shows, and we would visit them. As time went on, these people started going into the colleges and becoming art majors, and it changed the whole movement. Most of our collection is structural or architectural, and it's not the little pieces anymore. We don't buy those. We don't buy vessels after a fashion, but. No, that's what we buy is a structural piece.
And eventually, I mean, you also started buying pieces from international artists as well.
Yes, our collection is very international. Czechoslovakia, Germany, Italy, Bulgaria. There's a lot of artists. Wherever the artist is, we see them.
When did you start doing that, Myrna? When did you start seeking out artists and looking for specific work?
We don't go to seek them out. We travel with other collectors, other glass collectors. It's the AACG, which is the American Craft
Art Alliance for Contemporary Glass.
And we form a group, maybe 30 of us, and someone in the group plans the trip, and we go to Europe at certain cities, maybe 2-3 cities for about a month. And we find out who are the collectors there. And we go in and see private collections. And that's amazing because the Europeans do not open their door for people to come in. They're very tight within their collections.
Was there ever one trip or one place, one piece of work maybe, that you saw that was just mind-blowing for you?
In Europe?
Most memorable for you, yes.
Well, meeting the artists, really, because these are Europeans that always come to the United States, and that was always amazing. Most of them don't talk English, so that's even better.
Again, I'm talking with Myrna and Sheldon Paley, and you know what? You can check out some of their collection, because they have, over the years, as we've heard, over the years, they have been collecting art, glass art, from all over the world, and some of it is on display at the Paley Pavilion at the University of Miami's Low Art Museum. That is in Coral Gables. You know what? How did the pavilion come about? I mean, were you just out of room or what?
Okay. And we were aging, and we decided, what are we going to do with it? I mean, hundreds of pieces of glass. And we were very, very active with the University of Miami. We're both alum. And we spent one day with the provost, and one thing led to another, and we okayed to put up the building. So we built the building ourselves, no other underwriting, and they got the collection to go into the building.
Now, so how much of the collection is there, and how much do you still have at home?
As much as that's there.
Really?
Yeah. No, we didn't want anything really put in storage, so the pieces that they took are shown. The rest of the pieces are at home. We just did a renovation of the pavilion after 10 years, and different pieces were brought home, different pieces from the house were taken, and it also shows a number of other pieces that the collectors have donated to the museum.
Sheldon, tell me about your favorite piece at the pavilion.
They're really...
Oh, you got to have one.
Oh, I got to have one. My favorite piece, I think, is Libinsky. He's a Czech artist. He and his wife, they do mammoth architectural pieces. They're well known all through Europe. Corning has a huge piece of theirs.
Describe that piece.
It's a square piece on a pedestal, and it is clear, but it's filled with bubbles. And you look into it, and it looks like you're looking into the sky, into the universe, that you can see so much going on in it. It's clear, but it's not clear like optic glass. So it is cloudy, but it looks like the universe.
Oh, okay. All right, Myrna, what about you? Favorite piece?
I really don't have one. Oh. I really don't.
All right, so pick one anyway. Pick one that you like.
I guess I would have to go with Clifford Rainey.
Okay.
Who we are bringing down in a few months to do a demonstration and a lecture at the museum. And I think his work is absolutely outstanding.
Can you describe one piece for us?
Well, the piece that we have at the museum... If anyone had ever seen the film The Gods Must Be Crazy, many years ago, where this native is walking through the jungle, finds a Coke bottle, picks it up, doesn't know where it came from, looks up to the sky and says, "The gods must be crazy." Mm-hmm. And this is a piece in glass taken of that. The top piece is the head, and the bottom piece is the Coca-Cola bottle. And it's all encased and adorned. But it's amazing.
You guys had to educate yourselves on glass art,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, when did that start? Is it just what, reading a lot of books or finding?
No.
In buying. And you talk to the artists. How'd you do that? And how'd you do that? And then you just educate yourself by going from artist to artist.
Yeah, we were involved also in the Glass Art Society, which is a society made up of educators and...
Glass artists.
And we would go to their conventions, and you'd see the new artists, and you'd see the new things that were coming along and how they were doing it. In the early years, they did not want to interact at all with the collectors, so maybe... there were maybe a half a dozen collectors that would show up at these conventions and interact, and it was just marvelous. Now, of course, they've changed their mind, and they interact very, very much with the collectors.
What's one of the things that you learned about glass art that, is maybe the one thing that gives you that tickle? It's just, wow, that's amazing.
Well, one minute it's liquid and it's flowing, and the next minute is solid and gorgeous.
Have you ever had the chance to watch the process?
Oh, yes, all the time.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, we've been to many, many studios. It's mind-boggling. Sometimes I have to shut my eyes because I think it's going to fall.
I haven't seen one live, but I've seen them on tape. It is amazing to see how they handle this liquid. As you said, it's almost like a weird globby form.
That's it, yeah.
And they
silly
shape,
putty.
They shape it. And they solidified, and of course with the colors too, it's amazing. At one point it's got to be difficult, you know, when you guys are just these two young kids and you start collecting glass art, and you know that's not easy, and it ain't cheap.
No, it ain't cheap. And
well, we bought accordingly, as we could afford. We went along with the prices. Coming in today, you really have to have a lot of money. Because the younger people want to buy the fine, fine artists, but they don't want to pay that price. They want to pay from the students coming out of the university. Or the students coming out of the university feel, I can get that high price. They got to work their way up. So it comes from both ends.
We really had no money to begin with. And as I said, we would go to the art shows and you'd pick up a little piece here and a little piece there. As I got more successful, we were able to spend more money on the art.
So when you, if you were to talk to a younger version of yourself right now and they were trying to get into it right now, what's the advice you give them? How do you get into this game?
I think they would, if they would go to the art shows. We have the Coconut Grove Art Show coming up next week, and it's a wonderful art show. Myrna and I are going to be the judges for the glass, and there will be a lot of young artists there, and you try to look for something that they're doing that different, that they're doing, that they are trying to expand the boundaries of it.
A lot of the young artists come out, they imitate their teachers, and they cannot do that. They must learn all the techniques from their teachers, but then they must find their own avenue using those techniques.
Well, it's like the old great masters of the Renaissance. Yeah. You learn from your teachers, and then you span out and try to find your own way. But not everybody's a Leonardo da Vinci. So.
That's it.
You know what? The other thing, too, is I wanted to ask you, there's a mosaic is going to be installed this year? Right?
It's a Dale Chihuly piece.
Okay.
Many, many, many pieces, and it's going into the lobby.
Tell us a little bit about that one.
Well, it was...
Doug and Dale Anderson are collectors from Palm Beach in New York, and they are downsizing and changing. And this was a piece that was made especially for them.
Commissioned.
Commissioned for them by Chihuly, and it was in their house. And they have donated now to the university, to our pavilion.
And what it was is that they had a two-story penthouse, and the Chihuly was made to go up the stairs, many pieces that go up the stairs. Now it's got to be reorganized to be placed in one area.
Yeah, and Chihuly is sending down a team
to do it.
To do that.
He doesn't allow people to rearrange his work.
I can understand that. Why not? You're the artist. Are you still collectors, or at this stage?
No, we're still collectors.
You still are?
I have a piece going up as we speak.
Okay. Well, I mean, because you're still out there searching then.
Yes.
You said something earlier that's interesting is, you know, you have to start thinking about what are you going to do with all of this?
Yeah.
What are you? What's the plan? What's going to happen to it?
Most of it will go to the museum. Our children have picked out several pieces that they like. They didn't collect it, so they don't have any real feeling for it. They
right.
like art, but they like to collect their own art. But we go on trips with them, and they are learning, but they have their own tastes.
All right, but none of them are fighting over any particular piece or anything like that.
No.
Okay.
They have staked out what they want.
And there's enough to go around, believe me.
And there's enough to go. There's enough to go around.
You know, I wanted to, before we finish up, is ask you: is there an artist? Is there a style, a piece, or any part of the world that you haven't yet, added to your collection that you really want to go and find and collect? No,
nothing.
No.
We will run into something that we feel that we can't live without. Because we've done that, and as artists, they continue to change as well, and you'll see a new technique, and you'll see something new and different that you don't have, that you would like to have. Yes.
You know what? Can I ask you this, Myrna? Where do you find the best glass in the world?
No,
no one spot.
The best place that really, if I have to pick one place, I will say SOFA, Chicago.
Really?
And the galleries come in from all over the world, and they bring the best of glass. So if you can't go to Europe comes to you.
Yes, okay. Go up to Chicago.
All right, so go up to Chicago if you're going to find.
Yeah.
If you're not going to Europe, go to Chicago. Again, Myrna and Sheldon Paley joining me here in studio talking about the collection, and so much of it is at the Paley Pavilion at the University of Miami's Low Art Museum in Coral Gables. Myrna, Sheldon, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you for inviting us.
And again, I've seen some of the work, at least online. It is really absolutely beautiful.
Come visit the Low.
Go visit the Low and check it out for yourself.
Yes.
Well, that's the program for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.